Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Did you know the top 10 mobile games in the U.S. grossed more than $340 million in June? Do you want your game to earn more? AppFigures is all about giving game makers the tools they need to get more downloads and revenue. You may already know them for analytics and app store optimization. Now, AppFigures can help you keep track of competitors and the game market, from how many downloads they're getting and how much money they're making, to their audience demographics, and even which tools they use to power their games. Their competitor intelligence gives you great context. Got a great idea for an app or a game? With AppFigures, you can figure out how big the market is and how much money you could be making with it. Say a competitor adds a new feature or was mentioned in the news. With AppFigures, you can see if that brought in more downloads. And that's just scratching the surface. Whether you're growing your game or building a new one, AppFigures has what you need to reduce risk and get more downloads. Best of all, you don't need a large budget or data science degree to do this kind of thing anymore. AppFigures has made it affordable and simple. On top of tools, AppFigures also provides a lot of guides and tutorials to take you step by step through gaining more visibility with ASO and increasing your revenue by learning from your competitors. They just released a free guide on that, actually. Head to appfigures.com/on/gamedevunchained to try AppFigures for free. Again, that's AppFigures, appfigures.com/on/gamedevunchained to try it for free. If you like it, use our special code GDU3030 to get 30% off for the next 3 months. What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Game Dev Unchained, the number one game development podcast about game development and the lifestyle thereof. I am your host, Brandon Pham, and with me, not just one, not just two, but three special guests. Welcome to the show. It's going to be hard if I list them off, but I'm going to do it a little differently. I'm going to have you guys introduce yourself individually, and then we'll just get it going. So, Leanne, why don't we just start with you since you're kind of on camera right now?
Sure. Hi, I'm Leanne Taylor-Giles. I'm the narrative director at Dropout Bytes, working on Broken Roots.
I guess I'll go next then. I'm Colin McComb. I am the creative lead for Broken Roads and also co-owner of my own company called 3Pound Games.
And I'm Craig Ritchie, the co-founder of Dropout Bytes and the game director on Broken Roads.
Perfect. All right. So I kind of did like a pre-interview, but I'm going to have you guys reiterate again. Where is everybody at right now? so let's start with you.
All over the place. So I'm in Torquay in Victoria, Australia. So maybe an hour and a bit south of Melbourne. And the team is very, very spread around the world. I think there's only two people right now that work in the same office. That's Leanne and James. I'll let them talk about where they're at.
You have an office? I'm back in Brisbane. We just moved back from 10 years overseas in Montreal, Canada, which is absolutely beautiful, but we're happy to be back home with family. And as Craig mentioned, my husband is the animator on the project, so he sits behind me.
Cool. And Colin?
I am just outside of Detroit. If I had a better throwing arm, I could huck a rock into Detroit, but I don't.
Perfect. So let's talk about like the beginnings of the studio. All right. Was this, you were kind of mentioning the beginning of 2020, the pandemic before that. When did you guys start to kind of get together and decided to kind of let's make a game together?
Cool. So it started in kind of late 2018. I've been doing some freelance marketing and helping indies with Kickstarter. And I just ended up a gig and I was speaking to an old friend and a manager of mine from, well, previously CCP Games, who said, well, why don't you try and, you know, do your own thing this year? This was right at the end of 2018, start of 2019. I thought, you know, why not? I spoke to a friend of mine who has since, you know, become the co-founder of Dropbit Bytes, Jethro Nordia. And we said, look, we've got this potential, like good timing now. Let's see if we can create a demo. Let's see if we can get a small team together, start pitching to investors and publishers. And that was January 2019, founded the company. First team members on at the end of that month. And things kind of ramped up. We're very fortunate enough to live in a state that has really good government funding for games, and we managed to get some support from then Film Victoria, now Vic Screen, and put together a trailer and had a hands-on demo at PAX Australia 2019. And once that started getting us attention, neither Colin nor Leanne were on the team at the time, but after we kind of came out with the announcement and so on and got the attention, attracted a bit more funding, and then I was able to build the team with the talent we have today.
It's fantastic. One of the biggest questions that kind of been like a recurring question for the last 2 years is the the pandemic being such a huge thing for any type of development. How has that affected you guys? How has it affected your team? The remote thing sounded like from the beginning, the plan going forward. Did it change anything for you guys?
I mean, I can answer this one unless Leanne or Colin want to jump in.
You've probably got the best perspective on it.
Okay. Well, we were all remote before the pandemic anyway. There were a few of us in Victoria. So we would go to a shared workspace in the city of Melbourne, you know, sometimes once a week, sometimes every couple of weeks, but most of the people were just working from home. And as we expanded the team, we got people in Canada, South Africa, the UK. We were working with some artists in China for a while, North America in the case of Colin and Leanne, and more recently, our other narrative designer, Jesse. So we were all set up to go and, you know, remain remote. We were looking into what would it take to get a shared space or a more permanent studio here in Victoria. And then the pandemic changes all of those plans. And we were just like, well, we've been doing it remote for a little over a year anyway. Let's just get a little bit more disciplined when it comes to our, regular Google Meets or Slack calls. Really get the company culture embedded into our online comms. You know, Colin mentioned the rule zero, you know, always assume good intentions in like written communications. That's so essential when working online anyway, and even more so when you never see the people in person who you're working with. I mean, we're going on 3.5 years, and I think there's only a handful of people on the team who've actually ever met in person.
Mm-hmm. And I mean,
Leanne, I guess you're muted.
BY. I was going to say it's been such a boon for me and James as well, because when we were looking at moving back to Australia with our two small children, we weren't sure if we would have to live in Melbourne, which is where half of James's family is, but absolutely none of my family is. And so being able to be remote with Dropbit Bytes means we can have our family life and our work life very close together. And it's amazing for us. We absolutely love it.
Yeah, I mean, like one of the biggest benefits that we're seeing and everyone's been echoing is like the ability to kind of have our lives back. For a lot of people, I think the industry in particular is kind of notorious for crunch hours, being away from home, creatively being me more in the office than doing anything else. And so it was a welcome change, kind of like a forced change, not just our industry, but all industries worldwide. I think with smaller teams too, with especially indie teams, they are prospering much more. Obviously it should benefit all, but I do see the bigger studios in general have been struggling a lot more. And I would love to kind of hear you guys' thoughts, because it sounds like at the very beginning, you know, you see all these tech companies, they've been, you know, championing remote working, and slowly Google kind of backtracked, and then Facebook kind of starting to backtrack, and you can start to hear like, oh, you know, I read a story about someone applying for a job, and then only through the second interview in, they found out like, oh, they have to be within 10 mile radius remote working. Like they're starting, like these little discoveries are starting to happen kind of in a way. Like, have you guys been kind of hearing the same thing on that side where you guys are at with friends and family and whatever?
I'll jump in again. Both James and I were working at Ubisoft Montreal when the pandemic happened. And so we went to remote work. I had another child. So then we had a toddler and a baby at home, and we were both meant to be working full time once the maternity leave ended. We made that work. But being remote is really, like I said, such a blessing for us with two small children. It's a lot easier to manage our lives and see the people that we love being remote.
Yeah, and I have heard more about people being forced back into the office as well. Just because, you know, these larger companies, they've got, you know, the overhead of warehousing their employees. They've got to pay rent. They've got to pay for the parking. They got to pay for all of these benefits that they're not actually using, and it's just a massive financial drain for them. Whereas with a smaller studio, with a smaller studio, it's, you know, we're already remote, so we don't have to worry about reintegrating any of that, and it's just, you know, making sure the company culture stays solid.
One thing that is a little sad is that there's a very vibrant community in Mileland, which is where Ubisoft is, and lots of small businesses that relied on having X number of employees coming to work every day. So we spent a lot of time, because we lived nearby, patronizing all of those places and trying to spend as much money as we would have spent if we'd been working, to try to help keep them afloat. So there is that aspect to it as well. The community suffers a little bit when people don't go back, but I do think distributed living in villages is more sustainable and healthy than everybody flocking to one place.
Yeah. And with widely available broadband as well, it's going to make a huge difference. You know, and I think the problem is going to be coming up when a lot of the commercial leases start to come up, or the mortgages or whatever that people have been buying up. You know, I understand that's going to be happening fairly soon as well. So we're going to be seeing a lot of empty real estate pretty soon.
So do you guys feel like, just in a general trend, that it's kind of returning back to what it was before, or most likely 10 to 20%? Would adopt this kind of remote thing and the rest will go back? Like, what's the percentage here that you guys feel?
You know, I guess I can jump in on this, because I've seen some discussion in industry channels about it. You know, some people are talking like, you know, go into an office 1 to 2 days a week, you know, just sort of keep some of that and have people come in, just sort of touch base and make sure that they still have that human connection. But mostly the people I've been talking to are really excited to not be in an office and have to be on all the time, because it's like that bit in Office Space where the guy's like, yeah, you know, I come in and then I look at my email for an hour, and I would say I do maybe 15 minutes of work a day.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, yeah, I definitely want to hear more of you guys' why remote work does work. And why, for whatever reason, expanding that to a larger team hasn't been as successful. And I just want to highlight, I think there's without like the overhead of offices, and it's not like they can just go ahead and get rid of the lease. You know, there's a lot of dependencies that they've signed on. And I think if anything, a lot of middle managers don't want to let that go, to be honest. Like, they love the office.
For sure. There's a lot that goes into maintaining a work culture. And I think it's easier if you start off remote, like Dropbit Bytes did, because then there's no expectation that you're going to see each other. You know, I did really miss my colleagues from Rainbow Six. And in fact, I never met a bunch of my colleagues on Discovery Tour Viking Age because it was the pandemic. So I set up a coffee with the other writers and we would do that once every 3 weeks or something like that. But I haven't met the people I'm working with. And I think that's okay. We have a lot of calls. I know that everybody's going to go and see each other in Germany, and I'm hoping some people will come to PAX, so that will be exciting. But if you start off as a large team, so some of my meetings on Rainbow Six would be 40 people, that's really hard to manage in a call like this. You have 40 people on screen. Who are you looking at? Where do you look? You can't do those side glances to each other that you do when someone says something that you don't agree with. And it's also really exhausting to be on camera all the time because you're constantly looking at your own body language. Like, I'm gesticulating up here and in my face because that's where my face is on the screen. If I was talking normally, I would not be doing that. And so you get this real fatigue when you're on calls for 8 hours a day. At the end of the day, you're just absolutely wrecked in a way that you wouldn't be if you were chatting over coffee or seeing people for lunch or getting up and taking a walk around. And I think one thing that has really suffered with remote work is that people don't leave those breaks. So you have a meeting, then you have another meeting, and then it's 3 hours later and you haven't had any water and you haven't even left your room because there's just meeting after meeting and people don't think. Whereas when you're going from a physical meeting room to another meeting room, it's more acceptable to be a little bit late because you went to the bathroom as opposed to a call where everyone's like, okay, no, you're at your computer. You should be on time all the time. And it's really difficult to work with that kind of schedule.
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to talk about more Broken Roads. And what I'm also seeing is during the pandemic, a lot of like, social foundational games really got big, right? A lot of people were missing the interaction. And so there's a lot of multiplayer games that, you know, Fortnite just basically rule the world. Warzone in particular, right? Definitely kick ass. And now I'm seeing the trend kind of inverting back. Like there was that summer festival that just happened. Games like you guys is like RPG single player experience, a lot of single player experience. A lot of people just want to spend time alone now.
That's
have
right.
been trending really hard. So I don't know if you guys are noticing that too. And I would love to know your thoughts about it. Let's go with the Craig this time since you haven't talked for a while.
Cool. Yeah, look, we started with the single player game because that's what we, you know, it's what our passion is for a lot of us, what's our background is. And it was about a little over a year before the pandemic started. So we just kind of wrote it out and glad that there's that shift back to the single player experiences. Absolutely noticed that people were, I mean, myself, I played a bunch of the games you just mentioned as well, because we couldn't see our friends. So we would arrange like, okay, 6 p.m. Saturday, four of us are going to be playing Warzone or, you know, PUBG or Carl and I were playing Deep Rock Galactic. You know, we're just, just stuff that wouldn't necessarily be my first choice, but you don't have the, hey, let's go to the bar. Hey, you guys free to go to the restaurant? Like that kind of stuff just wasn't possible. And as the world slowly returning to normal, you know, we're talking about people going back to offices and stuff like that. I've seen outside of the industry as well, people are, a lot of companies are the 2 days a week in the office, 3 days from home. So they are getting that social interaction and maybe like we don't have to use games as much, you know, Jackbox Party Pack and all that might see a drop in sales now that people can get back into, I don't know, you name it. Like you said, there's a lot of single player RPGs and those deep immersive experiences are coming back and the timing is good for Broken Roads, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, I think one thing that did suffer during the pandemic was people's ability to concentrate. And I heard from a lot of people that it was the first time that they'd really been anxious and they had difficulty dealing with the brain fog. And so more intellectual experiences were hard to manage. And so people would go into these games that were like comfort food, which is great. Comfort food is great. And they just kind of wanted to zone out for a while. And so I feel like now that people have a more holistic life because they can leave the house and they can occasionally see people, they maybe have enough mental capacity to get back into those deep thoughts that eluded them when everything was very scary.
Yeah. I definitely noticed another thing where I'm sure you guys have kids or are near kids, you know, and as game developers, we look at them as like experiments for our own self needs, right? We're like, what games are you playing? My kids in that generation, 12 and under, are very, it's like single player RPGs, all these games we grew up with. I played Command and Card. I played everything growing up with Final Fantasy, everything. But they are very in tune with just multiplayer lately. And I always gripe about, I feel like they're missing, you know, the benefits of story development. You know, they obviously like movies. They obviously like, you know, going along for the ride. But for whatever reason, you know, game wise, they're just not naturally as attracted as we used to be. So I wonder if, you know, what your thoughts about that are, is when it comes to that lower, younger demographic.
So I'll use my kids as an example. They're 16 and 19 now, but they grew up on Minecraft, and you know, they still play it a lot. You know, heavily modded, playing with friends. You know, network servers, and they've picked up Roblox as well, which, you know, again, super super modded, playing all sorts of experiences that, you know, I'm like, hey guys, why not check out, say, Dishonored, or, you know, any of the Arcane games, or check out Half-Life, because I'm a huge Half-Life nerd. Check this game out. I love it so much. Hey, have you guys tried a role-playing game? And they're like, yeah, we tried a game like this. It was a mod in Roblox.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, come on, guys.
You know, my brother made an RPG on the graphics calculator that we used to have to use at school. So I'm very a fan of tools that are used for one thing being made to do another thing.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. And it's really cool. But, you know, at the same time, they're sort of, you know, stuck into this walled garden idea of, well, we've got this, you know, this one thing here, and we're going to just modify the hell out of it. And, you know, other people, you know, they pull in their other influences from like YouTube videos or streamers or whatever, and enjoy the games that way without actually having to put in the work on those games.
Yeah, it's are you gonna?
No.
I was gonna say that as somebody with no kids, I'm definitely the right person to answer this. I think that when we were playing games, say 80s, 90s on, it was consoles with maybe like, you know, two players could play it, sometimes not even simultaneously, right? Like old arcade games, or, you know, the early Mario Brothers, where once you die, your friend has a go. And then, you know, we probably had 14.4K modems, and then 28K, and all the way up to like the 56K days, where just playing Doom or Quake required, like, you had to know how to edit autoexec.bat and config.sys and all that kind of stuff just to play online. Whereas nowadays, I don't know what age, but I would guess 25 or under has never known a world where they're not permanently connected. And to play a sync, to kind of like divorce yourself from the interaction and the kind of connected socializing that is a part of, you know, I consume as a part of the consciousness all the time, would maybe just seem a little bit alien. It's like, well, I'm going to read a book, or I'm going to watch a movie, I'm going to do something that is completely solo experience, or I can just do the entertainment version of what I'm so used to doing with my connected devices anyway. So that's why I think the major push at the moment is the multiplayer games, and the absolutely massive successes, like the real huge money earners, are generally free to play, or you know, smaller, I should say, cheaper games that, well, I think you saw Among Us even going to free to play recently as well, because they get those numbers and they have the right appeal. But it's almost like such a divergence that it's a different skill set to create and manage and run those live services games to more traditional, you know, immersive, deep single player, maybe replayable, narrative driven games. Different beasts to create, different beasts to manage, and entirely different target audiences.
Yeah, you know, from the people I talk to, there's like trying to reassure me, it's like, oh, you know, the taste is evolving, you know. I mean, these are the future generations that have the ability to maybe create Ready Player One that we are struggling to make, right? Like, and I was like, all right, I'll be hopeful, but I don't know. I just see there's certain, you know, aspects to it. Like I was telling my son, like, hey, you should play Shadow of the Colossus. It changed my life. It's like, cool, Dad, I'll watch you play it. But
I signed it for a university group. Yeah, I signed it. Yeah. And I said, you know, because I know people can't always buy games, I said, here are four games. Some of them are free. If you can't afford to buy it, you can watch a Let's Play. And 100% of them did a Let's Play of Shadow of the Colossus. And I just sat there going, no, you have to play it.
It's not the same. Yeah.
It's such a different experience to play, but they're so used to. And I have friends who are, you know, 25 and under who are very used to just going on Twitch and looking up a game that they're interested in and then watching that. And they have this rapport with the person who's playing the game, who's a complete stranger. I miss LAN parties. My last LAN party was when WoW came out. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm picking up your massive CRT monitor and going there and then putting it on the table, getting everything out of the car, hooking it all up, configuring TCP protocols. It's very different now.
Yeah, but don't forget as well that, well, the most recent data that I saw, I think from last year, the year before, that median, or you know, game player is a 35 or 36 year old with a getting closer and closer to 50-50 male-female split. And so while we do see what all the kids are playing and those are the massive numbers and the earners and so on, there's a lot of people playing, whether it's mobile games or picked up a Switch or whatever they could get, the hardware shortages, or, you know, discovering games on Steam and that kind of thing that are in their mid to late 30s. I think that's still the largest demographic, having grown up from the console days and so on until now. Like they're out there, you know.
Well, definitely the gamer base have grown tenfold over the pandemic. Everyone was basically a gamer, which is great for us. And like anything, their taste gets more and more expert level, and they venture out from the basic mobile games to the more hardcore PC or even console. That's exciting. That's great. There's a plethora of games that, you know, they can discover on and play with. So Broken Roads, all right, post-apocalyptic in Australia. Another trend I saw during the pandy is a lot of people were into post-apocalyptic, you know, top 10 Netflix. They were like living through a pandemic wasn't real enough. You know, that was like the biggest highlight. So were you guys able to kind of see that as well? Was that part of like, let's double down on this and let's make it even post-apocalyptic? People are loving it.
The biggest problem we have had is that we are looking at the news, we're looking at all of these things happening, and we're like, okay, well, now we've got to change our story a bit because this is just getting too close. We're like predicting the future here. So, you know, we're dialing it into a slightly different direction than what is actually happening because, you know, we don't want to be like, we're just not, you know, we're not the game that rips off the headlines.
Yeah.
The headlines are ripping off us, I believe, is what's actually happening. Yes.
So as you guys were kind of developing the story and this was happening, how many times did you guys have to shift things around as we were learning new information?
I think it was more some of the backstory. There are a couple of things where we wrote a timeline in early 2019 of how the world got to the state that it's in at the start of Broken Roads. And then, you know, quite literally some of the things started to happen. And or such a close parallel that we'd either have to shift it that, okay, like this thing is now that we said that we wrote as like some fantasy of 2035 or whatever it is. Okay, well, it looks like China's doing that now. Let's change either the date or change what the event was. And then also as we've researched certain things in Western Australia and the towns and locations that the game is set in, we've also found things that are like, okay, we should adjust our story a little bit because what's really there is so good anyway. We don't need to, we can rather expand on what's real. Or something is, there's something I could say which would be too much of a spoiler, so I rather won't. But there's a date coming up in about 13 years time that we're now going to adjust something, and it's fit into our story really, really well. So yeah, a little bit of that, and just kind of adjusting things on the fly. We're kind of so late into things now that we can only really amend timeline and backstory stuff. But when we find some gems, like we did on our recent trip to Western Australia, myself and Leanne and Tim, our composer and audio lead, drove through. There we go. So Leanne's holding
Leanne,
up,
you gotta say something.
The video.
Oh, I am holding up the ghost towns and hamlets around Southern Cross that I picked up at the Shire of Yilgarn Museum, which is a printed document that's been printed probably at home on someone's computer. And it's just full of amazing little details that we absolutely would not have known if we had not gone there and picked these up. So I really recommend go to Southern Cross.
Yeah, it seriously is the game that writes itself. Well, apart from actually putting the words in.
It doesn't do that for us.
No. Yeah, there's also a really good project here to digitize gazettes and newspapers and newsletters and stuff from these towns dating back to, I think, the 1800s. So you can also go online and search for, let me find some news about this place. Let's just stay on Southern Cross that, so-and-so's donkey was stolen and in 1865 and they caught the man responsible, and you find these really, really cool stories that just help you enrich the game. So we've been dealing with the adjusting real world, the discoveries about the places as we've gone to see them, and then little tidbits that we find either written by residents like Leanne showed you, or just things we discover from the last couple hundred years from the online library archives.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that I just want to keep stressing, like the growing up playing these type of single player RPG experiences. As a gamer, I fell in love with them. As a game developer, and maybe obviously I'm probably biased because I work mostly on single player experiences, they're just so much more fun to kind of tell a story, obviously, right? I mean, multiplayer story, not to kind of dog on any of them, but like story's kind of, secondary, tertiary. It's kind of like a add-on, nice to have information, which is great because in the end, great games play well, right? But there's just certain stories that are better told through interactive experience, like our medium. And I feel like games like you guys, is what you guys are making, are a great illustration of calling back to those times. It's like, hey, remember, this is the only way we could do it. And with turn-based strategy, I was a big fan of XCOM, playing through pretty much all of them. Tabletop games made the comebacks for the last 10, 20 years, picking up steam. Turn-based kind of reminds me a lot of the tabletop games that I used to play. These elements, obviously, were probably inspiration for you guys. How do you see this medium pushing forward, right? Because there's a lot of things that are happening trying to emulate RPG like experiences, like the metaverse. We keep hearing that the last 2 years, another thing that everyone keeps repeating. But I feel like PlayStation Home did it better than what we're seeing now, which is crazy to think about. Everyone just forgot, like,
well, IMVU, which is still around, very oddly. If you used IMVU, it was a chat program where you could spend real money to buy clothes for your avatar. And it was pretty impressive.
Yeah. But like what they're trying to do is the RPG game pretty much, right? And what's the disconnect here where those teams are not able to kind of get it going? Like what as like experienced RPG players, game developers, what are you guys seeing between, your games and what they're trying to do with the metaverse that's missing here?
I'm going to defer to Colin with his many years of tabletop experience.
Yeah. And, the VR development as well. That's a really good question. And I think part of it is, it's a lot of different people with a lot of different visions are trying to just sort of smash stuff together, or, you know, people are trying to throw up their like, okay, well, here's the, you know, here's the metaverse from, I don't know, GM Auto, and here's the metaverse from Ford. And then here's a, you know, here's Meta's metaverse. And then, you know, there's all these people trying to do their thing. And there's only the very tenuous, loosely connected strands between them. And when they're trying to say, well, you know, we're just going to use NFTs to tie this together, it's like, come on, you guys. You know, it's not a magic bullet. And just repeating the words blockchain at me is not going to solve the problem either. But I think that people are slowly getting more and more into it. If developers can recognize that what we're looking for is a hub for experiences that we can then branch out to, and if you can make that seamless, then you're going to have a much better chance of actually seeing your vision of the metaverse take off.
Mm-hmm. They kind of did that with Oculus Home, right? You would go in and it's this beautiful palatial mansion that you can look around, and then you can also access your games from there. But I think the most important thing to recognize is that 90% of storytelling and relationship making happens in the player's head, but they need a rich resource to draw on to fill in the gaps. So if you have this empty stadium with a whole bunch of people in it, it's not as compelling as one or two characters that are very well detailed and don't necessarily have too much to say. But when the player interacts with them, they feel like a real human being, then they will be able to build those connections much more inside their own head, rather than relying on putting a bunch of people in a place and saying, okay, now it's a party. I don't know about you. I don't go to parties with a bunch of people that I don't know, that I've never seen, that I will never see, that I don't know if they're even real.
Especially corporate parties.
Yeah, right? That's right. Yeah. I'm not going to go hang out at the metaverse party, even if I was invited, which I wasn't. you know, it's a bit naive to think that a bunch of people who have nothing in common except the fact that they all have a VR headset are going to be any kind of monolith that's going to enjoy hanging out together.
Right. And people need to self-select for these things too. And like Altspace has some really good VR raves, for instance. Rec Room has really good stuff for generally a younger crowd. Although we tried to introduce a lawyer friend of ours to it, and he got about 20 minutes in and kids were just griefing him. So he, it was hilarious, but, he took the headset off. He's like, this VR is not for me. But there's like Neverwinter Nights started doing dungeon design back in, Jesus, what was it, 2000, 2001? Mm-hmm. So I think if we can provide building blocks for people to create their own things, and this is sort of the lesson of Roblox and Minecraft as well, if we can provide people the building blocks to create their own visions of this and then invite people to them, I think that is where you're going to really see the organic growth.
Mm-hmm. So Second Life.
Exactly.
Second Life resurgence.
Like I'm saying, I feel like we figured all this out in 2000. But everyone just
you still got the penis problem. So
there's a lot of those issues.
Just assume everything. The spore problem with the generated aliens. Yeah, it's gonna happen. Just embrace it.
Well, you were talking about like the rich history, the rich resources to pull from earlier, and that is exactly what you guys are doing with Broken Roads. It's crazy that I can't really think of a post-apocalyptic game that takes place in Australia. I've seen New York destroyed in so many ways. Like a lot of these games are always in America, and it's kind of been becoming like the same palette, the same type of story. Well, you know, apart from maybe the obvious, why Australia? Why there? Why did you guys want to make this game around that location?
Mad Max.
Mad Max.
Except, this game is really not Mad Max. I'll let Craig speak to this though, because you know it's his vision.
We were thinking it originally started off just generic post-apoc place, but then within the first month or two, we were like, why don't we do this as a journey across Australia? It's so there's so much good stuff here. There's so much range of landscapes and biomes in the literal sense, like different, you get desert and you get tropical and you get thick forest and you get dry scrublands and all those as well as being.
You guys already have a lot of things that can kill you.
I've had to train my daughters since we moved back. I have to train them to like hit their shoes out if they leave their shoes out overnight. I'm like, okay, before you put your foot in, you have to pick the shoe up, hit it against the ground, look inside, make sure there's nothing. Yeah. And they're like, what could be in there? I'm like, nothing, honey. It's perfectly fine.
This is pre-apocalyptic. Yeah,
it's like post-apocalyptic out the box, exactly. So then just having a look around, kind of surprised that there weren't more games set in Australia and that even some Australian teams were doing games set in the United States or Europe. And it was like, well, why don't we bring it back to, you know, Colin mentioned Mad Max. That's I think where everyone goes to kind of, it wasn't the first, but it really planted a flag in what set the idea of post-apocalyptic cinema for people. And you know, we lean on the obvious big names like Fallout games and, you know, other titles that have since done things first. Like, how do we draw on that so that we're similar enough that fans of the genre recognize what they love, but still create a distinct brand, a distinct identity for ourselves? And that Australianness is really central to the game. Without having to lean in on ridiculous stereotypes, you can kind of dip your toes in the stereotypes and find enough genuinely interesting and different content right here. Such a wide range of people and different cultures. The different states are also, that, you know, people have different slang depending on where you are and that kind of thing. It's one big country with a lot of difference in it, beautiful landscapes, tons of locations, and so much kind of history and difference that you can draw upon, that we were originally going to do the whole journey across Australia for the game. And we limited just to one state. And we're like, there's so much in Western Australia. And even that got limited down to just one section of Western Australia. And there's already so much variety. The start of the game looks very different to where you get to the mid and the late points in the game, which totally mirrors the real world Western Australia.
Yeah, I don't think people realize how big Australia actually is. I mean, for context, saying, yeah, we're going to go all the way across Australia, it's like, yes, we're going to have our game go from Los Angeles to New York. Mm-hmm. It's essentially that far. And, you know, with the same sort of variety in scenery through there. So, yeah, it was like scope reduction, smash this down. Mm-hmm.
And I will say I wanted to work on Broken Roads because it was set in Australia, because Colin was working on it and he's like, hey, these are some cool people you might want to chat to. But I think there's something about post-apocalyptic settings that's a love letter to the civilization that you live in, and that by destroying what you love, you can appreciate it a lot more. And we have so many stories of destroyed America, but I want to see my country destroyed and rebuilt so I can see what's important to me and the people that I love.
Water.
Yeah, yeah. It's just water, actually. Tank girl was right.
Well, you know, what I love about what you guys are doing and what I love about bringing these experiences, that, you know, the foundation of indie development has changed so much since what's that game? Meat Boy, right? Super Meat Boy, right?
Super Tofu
when it's
Boy.
Like, when you think indie before, it's like, oh, manageable, a couple people, we can figure this out, it's doable. I mean, it's hard, it's very hard still, but it's like, when you look at that type of game, it's a very good game. It's like, yeah, I can see how two people can make this. And so, like, when I see games like you guys, where I think 15 years ago, even 10 years ago, it's like, oh, you're talking about a team of 50 to 100. And a lot of that has been because the tools, the availability of what we can do now with a smaller group of people have improved so much. I would say the last 5 years, you know, Unreal, Unity being free, Substance, all these different artistic tools, technical tools, that is more freely available, have just made the possibility of making these dream projects come true with lower resources, right? Well, at least in terms of people. Were there another time where, not just the chance of you guys getting together, where you guys were able to kind of have the same group work on this game earlier? Or was this just, this is the perfect time because everything kind of lined up in terms of the tools, the engine, the pandemic, like Like, is there something special about this time period? Yeah,
this was absolutely a coming together of a lot of things at the right time. This was myself and my co-founder both having the opportunity at the right time to found a company going without other obligations that would have prevented, you know, because it's game development is hard. Game development is incredibly competitive. Running a startup and starting one is incredibly hard. So you like combining the two and doing the worst of it all. But the timing was right for us at the start of 2019 and moving in. You know, when I started, I had been in Australia for a few years. I didn't know that Victoria and the state government offer all the various funding things that they do, and that all became clear, you know, a couple of months after starting Drop Bear Bytes, and then seeing what those programs are like, being fortunate enough that PAX Australia is, you know, less than an hour and a half from my house, so I could drive my own TV up there and the car's like full of my own stuff as opposed to renting all the equipment and running a booth that I also have to fly everybody in for and that kind of thing. Then Unity and, like you said, Substance and so many tools, not only being free, but being absolutely commercial quality as well. And the basic free, like full featured Unity license for small teams or teams with the revenue under, at the time it was 100,000, it might've changed now. That has entirely made it possible. Then there, you know, there were some industry happenings in Melbourne and studio closures and that meant that I had suddenly look at this like talent that is able to join my company, especially because they don't have to travel into a studio, which works for some people and doesn't work for others, but we managed to get a team together. And then I think Colin, when we spoke at the start or late 2019, start of 2020, I was lucky enough that he was in a point where he could take on another writing gig. And yeah, you know, pandemic time, James and Leanne wanting to move back to Australia. My co-founder moved to Australia recently as well. So I do think that there was very much an alignment of things. The Australian government is doing a hell of a lot to promote Australian games as an export product. So we've got not only the state initiatives like the film and screen bodies that give funding to games, but also tax incentives, rebates on employee salaries. We've also got the marketing expenses. Like if you go to an international show, you can get a certain number up to maybe $30,000 or something back on your trade shows. So there's so much happening that has just made, I don't think a year on either side would have worked. You know, I think we got very, very lucky with our timing. And especially with the circumstances of the individual members of the team that we've been able to bring together was like, that was just a pure stroke of good fortune.
It's a recurring theme. The more I do these interviews with international developers about how countries like game development and not the United States, there's like nothing. It's like people are still confused what games are over here. At least in the general public knowledge, is like, you know, all people actually make games? I thought my kids are just playing them.
You've got to make that tax revenue angle more known to the government, because once they recognize, oh wow, this is like bigger than Hollywood and bigger than the recording and like music, oh okay, maybe there's some let's support this.
Bigger than professional sports, what?
Don't understand it.
No, you guys are just murder simulators, that's all, just training our kids to kill.
Yep, that's still the thing here. I do want to ask you guys, well, Leanne especially, you know, one of the things that I see a lot in terms of career is that, you know, first coming in, all our hopes and dreams for a regular game developer is like, oh, I want the biggest, best studio ever. I love these games. And then myself included, I find myself at a certain point, it's like, I don't want to make these big games as much anymore and wanted to go exactly the opposite. And it's like a second career, what you call it, birthing of understanding what I really want. And I kind of had like a midlife crisis. I don't know if you had a similar experience.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to move to America or North America so that I could work on the big games with lots of people and reach as many people as possible. I had the chance to work with Colin on Torment, which was a dream of mine. I have the symbol of torment on my wrist that I got for my 29th birthday. And so I did that. And then I released a couple of big games. And then I worked on a game that had, you know, 50 million players. And then I went, but I want to do something that I really care about. And that's education. And that's deep thinking and philosophy and not telling people what to think, but allowing them to be open to other ideas and introducing them to concepts they might not come across in their daily life. And so when I was thinking about that, and Colin put me in touch with Craig, we had a very interesting discussion about kindness and whether you can be kind to inanimate objects or not. And that kind of sparked a really good discussion. And that was why I wanted to join Dropbear Bytes and do something that was much more in line with what I personally wanted to achieve. Is now I've done the big games. It was fun. I really enjoyed it. It was a great time working on all of those games with all of those so talented people. But at the end of the day, I want a couple of people that I connect with really well, and I want to make a game that I connect with really well.
Yeah. It's a very weird thing because I same story. I hear it a million times, but like I basically kind of hark back to when I was in school doing those little projects with my friends. It's like, oh, that's when I really liked game development and would stay up all night and take as many days and months to kind of complete it. And it's funny how the indie group nowadays is so much more about these veterans kind of getting together and wanting to do that for the rest of their lives. And it's just such an interesting thing that I've been seeing the last 5-7 years, that everybody, which leads me to things like, man, these AAA games are getting harder, getting bigger. And if all these veterans are leaving all the time, like, you know, great, make room for the newbies, but like, you know, are they ready for that type of stress? Are, you know, are games going to degrade a bit because all the veterans are not around to tell them, don't do that. That's going to take way longer. You know, these type of little things I'm always kind of seeing that's happening right now.
I'm sure management really will show them the question. Way.
Management. Fire more people? You mean throw more people at it, maybe?
I'm big on process. And so one of the things that I do whenever I join a project with, which both Craig and Colin can attest to, is I come in and I write a lot of documentation and I say how we should be doing things. So I try to leave that in place because I know that I'm not going to be there forever. So hopefully people follow those processes, they can learn from my mistakes, but yeah, it is talent bleed is a bit of a problem.
Well, this is a question for Craig and Colin, right? So, you know, Stranger Things, the reemergence of, well, I mean, that show is still popular. Dungeons & Dragons, because of it, is like getting reintroduced to a new generation. RPG has always been like this very distinct corner niche market, right? People who are into it, they love it. People who haven't touched it, you know, they're like always, you know, squinting their eyes like, what exactly is it? You pretend to be someone else, right? But like, what exactly about RPG that you guys think is just going to stay here forever, that people are loving and it continues trying to emulate it? They don't want to call it, but that's what the metaverse is. They're trying to redefine it, but it's literally RPG. What is it about RPG that just makes people just want to invest thousands of hours into?
It's communal storytelling. That's one of the fundamental features of humanity, is that we're communal creatures and we love stories. You know, stories help define us. They help shape our lives. They help shape how we think and how we approach the world. And RPGs allow us to do that in both a safe space and with a group of friends. And it forges bonds between people that, you know, even if your group breaks up, there's still, you know, always going to be that bond with you where you shared this imaginary formative experience, essentially. And I don't think that anybody who has actually gotten into role-playing games is ever going to forget, you know, how that made them feel. And if they share it with other people, then it's going to continue spreading out. And, you know, that's really the dream of, say, the metaverse, and for like the kind of game we're making right now, is just to create an experience that people will latch onto, that will help them approach their, you know, approach how they view the world, and hopefully, you know, help them approach it in a sane and rational way.
Yeah, look, I agree with all of that. I think one of the things to bring it to computer role playing more than tabletop, because I've done some tabletop more recently. Pandemic Roll 20, all that's allowed us to play tabletop online as well, which has just been such a fantastic experience. But the big, deep, immersive single player RPG, I mean, I don't know if you can see on the shelf behind me, I've got all the SSI Gold Box games, I've got the Ultimate mm-hmm. games, I've got the Baldur's Gate games. There's something to that, being in that other world. I mean, old Origin had the best slogan, you know, we create worlds. You really felt like you were somewhere else, and you were able to let your childlike, you know, imaginative play, but happening in a canvas somebody else is busy writing the story. You can mm-hmm. take from it what you want. You can kind of interact with this art. I mean, it's there's some games that are pure action and it's a challenge and it's about skill or it's about competitiveness, and there's other things that are more, you know, much deeper, and the there's an emotional impact, and there's a something that can quite literally change you. You can take something away. I mean, for me, that was Ultima 6 and 7, the depth of the story writing, the virtues, the, you know, my real introduction to philosophy came from those games. And then I ended up, you know, studying philosophy about 7 years at university and building a game where the USP, the central mechanic to our alignment system, is the moral compass, is, you know, mm-hmm. traced back to through my history all the way through to these games where I it must have been hundreds of hours, because that's another thing, is a different world between the 90s and now. In the 90s, you didn't always get a new game every month, let alone have mm-hmm. 1,000 games in your Steam catalog and Xbox Game Pass and Humble Choice and, you know, PlayStation Plus. Like, we are so flooded with games now that we always have a backlog, and if something's losing our interest, like, okay, my attention goes to what's going to satisfy me more. Whereas mm-hmm. playing the old Ultima games or the old Dungeons & Dragons games, you had weeks and weeks and weeks to get through all of the content and chat to everybody. And you were just like, you play at your own pace. And, you know, before the internet, you couldn't get walkthroughs. You'd have to solve mm-hmm. it yourself. And I had a handwritten journal because there was no in-game quest log or journal. And I would like draw the maps and write the notes and stuff like that. And it became this experience that you were a part of for a while. So like, you had your school life and you were off playing sport and you're doing these things. And you had this one thing that was like, okay, well, this is what I'm doing in my own time. And I have a relationship with these characters, these little avatars on the screen. And I put myself in that world, and you take something away from that I think no other medium quite gets, like the deep single player computer role playing game. And to just like scratch that same thing that I got from the Ultima games in the 90s or Baldur's Gate and Planescape Torment and the like in the early 2000s. If we can hit that with Broken Roads, you know, then we've achieved our goal.
Well, also, we hear a lot about meaningful choices in our industry. You know, we want the player to feel like they have agency. And we also hear a lot about power fantasies, but when you're a child, you don't have much power. And so sometimes just being able to make a choice in a game is a form of power that can be very uplifting for a child. I think now there are other platforms for that, you know, Instagram and how you want to present yourself to the world is very different to playing Baldur's Gate when you were however many years old and using that to form your identity by yourself. But being able to have control over something, just in the sense of the game recognizing who you are and seeing how those consequences play out, is really powerful for especially young kids.
Yeah, I think you guys completely nailed why the metaverse isn't working. It's like, because to me, a game is always about rules and boundaries. And right now, everything else, at least socially, there aren't any of that. You know, so a lot of people who get into that are kind of defining those, and a lot of in bad uses or good uses, it's very hard, right? So to have those in an RPG like game like yours, and having someone walk you through a game experience is one of the most fun things growing up. Like even when you were talking about like you can't just go online to kind of once you're stuck in something, to me that was a story, that was experience where I would either get so upset, I just turn it off and come back to it. But figuring it out is like one of the biggest things, takeaways as a kid growing up, just figuring something out. And I feel incredibly guilty, you know, going all the Barnes and Nobles, looking through the strategy books, just like, I can't, like, but like that alone is like such a precious type of experience that I think nowadays nobody really, you know, at least the younger generation doesn't do anymore. But with that being said, Colin, Craig, Leanne, we did hit that hour mark. I want to thank you guys for coming on and hanging out with me for an hour. It's very hard for most people, but this is the part where I kind of hand the mic over to you. I think I'll just hand it to you, Craig, to kind of give a shout out, give attention to, tell people out there how to find Broken Roads and all the information they need to kind of get connected to you guys.
Cool. Well, we've got our website, brokenroadsgame.com. We're on Twitter. We've also got a YouTube channel, but I think the best way to interact with us is, of course, on Discord or to wishlist on Steam and follow that community. We've actually got a pretty decent following on Steam, so we try to do quite a bit of activity there and run video AMAs and that kind of thing. But yeah, so please join us, come along, meet the devs, chat in the Discord, and you know, follow us on this journey. We're getting into the tail end of development now. Some really exciting reveals coming in the next few weeks and months. So yeah, and thanks again, Brandon, for inviting us. It's been great.
Of course, man. Always fun to chat with you guys. And that's it. Thank you guys for joining in. I'll see you guys next week.